This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, restaurants are getting ready for colder weather. That means for many, outdoor dining won't be an option. We'll hear how some are preparing for the months ahead. In one Illinois town, police did not have body cameras, so a group of women decided to change that. We'll listen to their story. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan has a new book about why he put a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois. Until then, Ryan had been in favor of capital punishment.
I said to myself, I'm for the death penalty. I sure wouldn't want to throw the switch. And little did I know that that pressure came to haunt me then, some 20 years later.
Former Governor Ryan joins us. And we'll have the tale of two college campuses in Illinois both dealing with COVID-19 and taking different approaches. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, former Illinois Governor George Ryan. He put a moratorium on the death penalty before leaving office. He's out with a new book that gives insight to that decision, and he'll join us. Also, a tale of two universities and how each are handling COVID-19. We'll also hear from a front yard farmer. That and more this hour on Statewide. First this week, with the fall upon us, restaurants are getting very nervous because the next few months are deeply uncertain for their businesses. Colder weather could make outdoor dining impractical, and indoor dining hinges on COVID-19 infections staying low through the winter. Owners say they're preparing for the cold months ahead, and employees are fearing they could be out of a job. From Chicago, Vivian McCall has the story.
Another rainy September day, which for restaurants can be the difference between breaking even and losing money. Michael Roper owns Andersonville Tavern Hopleaf and says on a good day, the restaurant makes 30% of pre-pandemic sales. But on this day, it's dreary.
There is no profit. Right now, the attempt is to break even.
But those rainy day sales may seem bountiful by December.
And remember that last year on Halloween Day, it snowed. Heaters only gain you a few days. Once it's windy and sleet and ice and snow and really, really cold weather, those heaters are useless.
If you ask a restaurant owner what they expect to happen, they'll shrug, laugh, or look very sad. The change in seasons is bad news on top of bad news. Workers are getting antsy, too. Business is already slowing down, and going back on unemployment when checks can come months late sounds nightmarish. Roper says November will tell the industry how to move forward.
If things don't change and, you know, you get to the end of November, you might see a tidal wave of closings.
To break it down, the winter could be the start of a domino effect. Restaurants losing outdoor tables means cutting up to half of their seating. And at the time it's too cold to eat outside and everyone heads indoors, there's worry COVID-19 could spike, which could then push the state to restrict restaurants even more. That leaves takeout, which is peanuts for most. Now, consider the financial help restaurants have gotten. That Paycheck Protection Program, the money restaurants are using to help pay their workers, that runs out for most by fall. Carrie Nahabedian owns the fine French restaurant Brondi in River North. Downtown unrest and damage to the business kept them closed until the end of July, so they haven't had time to reap summer's bounty.
I couldn't go to our bank right now and say, I need some money. They'd say, that's great, but what are you going to give me as collateral? They're not going to give it to you just because you're a great chef.
So the question is, what the heck do they do? Sam Toya of the Illinois Restaurant Association has some ideas. He's working on a congressional relief bill called the Restaurant Recovery Fund and also wants to increase indoor dining capacity in Chicago from 25 to 50%.
The federal government should step up with the Restaurant Recovery Fund of $120 billion and have independent restaurants be able to draw off this for labor, product cost, and their rent /mortgage.
The city's solution is a design challenge to make winter dining viable and received 600 submissions, but owners are skeptical about what could work on a large scale. Kelly Chang of Sunwa Barbecue isn't banking on Congress or the city to save the day. Her family-owned restaurant is an uptown fixture known for roast pork and its crispy ducks, which are seen hanging in the window. Early in the pandemic, the Chang family decided they'd have to get over fear or give up the business.
You have to get past that, and you have to move forward, and you have to say, okay, I'm done with standing in place. What can I do to push me forward?
Her Ace in the Hole is an event space upstairs with enough seating to make up for outdoor dining. They've also got a plan to do one-week pop-ups where suburban customers live. If things get worse, Chang says they'll stay flexible because they've already had to be.
To be honest, we've never carved the ducks to go if we could help it because we know the quality is greatly reduced. And we've already said once this is over, we're back to our very controlling ways.
Cliff Rome didn't bother with indoor dining at all. He owns Bronzeville restaurant Peaches and instead focused on how to make to-go better. He switched from styrofoam packaging to boxes that keep food hotter for longer and now sells bake-at-home rib dinners. But Rome knows everyone can't make those pivots.
A lot of restaurants can't do that because their menu is sometimes set up on the experience, which means that maybe it's a lot of plates. They took a lot of time and money to think out how they wanted the presentation to be inside the restaurant. So you can't say that something happens overnight and now I'm changing that whole motto and it's going to work. No, it doesn't happen that way.
The fate of these restaurants has an even bigger impact. The thousands of restaurant workers who have no say in what happens. One employee who does not want her name used has applied for over 150 jobs since March. She found one, and after 8 years in the industry, will be working from home in customer service. She feels relieved, but worries for the coworkers she's leaving behind.
But I think the guilt set on pretty early when I put in my notice, and then I had to tell my coworkers. But I mean, they were all really supportive and happy for me, but I could see like the panic in their eyes, knowing that like it is possible to get out.
Jordan LaWanda says as a recent hire, she'd be the first to lose her job. And when the pandemic first hit, she didn't get unemployment for over 3 months and survived because friends shared stimulus money with her. Even if she keeps her job, LaWanda says working in the industry is exhausting, a trade of mental health for financial stability. For now, she's just thinking about how to keep spending low.
Going into fall and winter, I feel at once scared that things will repeat, but I almost feel prepared. I almost feel like I've done it before, so I can do it again. In a coping way, I'm kind of refusing to let myself dive too deep, except in terms of preparation.
For some, the most they can do is wait and watch the leaves fall, steeling themselves for what is sure to be a long winter. Vivian McCall, WBEZ News.
The consumer watchdog group that polices Illinois Public Utilities is facing some new questions about its independence. Dave McKinney explains.
A WBEZ investigation finds the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, has accepted more than $11.5 million from two Commonwealth Edison-funded foundations since 2000. ComEd has admitted to bribing its way to some big Springfield wins, though CUB itself hasn't been implicated. The former top public utilities official in the Attorney General's office, Janice Dale, says the legislature needs to reassess CUB and how it gets its money.
Creating loopholes and ways for consumer advocates to receive utility money is wrong, and that kind of conflict should be stopped.
CUB Executive Director David Collada says the utility-linked dollars haven't compromised his group's independence. This is Dave McKinney.
The Black Lives Matter movement gained momentum this spring when video emerged of a white Minneapolis police officer killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Videos of other acts of police violence against blacks have also emerged. All of this led a group of Macomb women to question why police in their community don't wear body cameras. The women did more than ask questions. They started a campaign to help raise money to buy the equipment. Rich Egger reports.
The campaign is called Because We Care. Two of the group's four organizers are black and are the daughters of former police officers. Vanessa Houston says that helps her see how cameras can help officers and the public.
I have that insight of how things happen as a policeman, but I also have the other side of with him being the first police officer of color here in Macomb. We got calls to our house. We got threats to our house and that kind of stuff. So I also know that side of not feeling safe, too.
Houston's late father, Bill Thorpe, became Macomb's first black police officer in 1961. She acknowledges body cameras won't catch everything that happens at a scene.
But But I think it's better to have some footage versus just relying on what this one over here saw and what that one over there saw and what somebody else told somebody else and that kind of stuff.
Houston police and those they're interacting with might tend to be on their best behavior if they know they're being recorded. Kyra Arude is the group's other daughter of a former police officer. She says her father, Theodore Jefferson, was the first black police sergeant in Monmouth, so she does not agree with negative stereotypes about police officers.
I'm used to, from seeing my dad at work, seeing the positive and the impact that he had in the community. So I feel that it's a win-win for people of color and the police officers.
Arude says the fundraising campaign has ruffled the feathers of a few people who question why the public should raise money for the police department. She's heard comments such as,
I've seen the budget, there's money for the cameras, take it out of my taxes, why should I contribute? You don't necessarily have to, it is a choice. But also know that the body cameras are for the very people who are having, you know, issues with this campaign. It's for their protection as well.
Body cameras for police officers have been available for a few years. So why aren't Macomb cops already using them? Police Chief Kurt Barker says he likes to do his research before making such purchases.
The Panasonic body-worn camera that we're going to be fielding is going to be at least the fourth version. So you can see how it's progressed this quickly, because they started fielding that maybe 5 years ago and we're already on the fourth version. And you never want to be the first person to go in and take that initial equipment.
Barker says the body cameras will integrate with other Panasonic equipment the department already uses, including cameras mounted in squad cars. Barker thinks the body cameras will be good for officers and for the public. And he believes the members of Because We Care have their hearts in the right place.
They have always come forward and tried to work with us on all their reform efforts. And this is just one step to work together and to help get this through and build trust.
Barker says Because We Care's fundraising will help his department buy body cameras more quickly. He hopes to have his officers using them by next spring. The women say the pandemic prevents them from holding in-person fundraising events, so they started a GoFundMe page. That page says they have raised more than $28,000. Their goal is to raise $33,000, which would cover half the cost of buying 25 cameras, the software, and the installation equipment. The group's Sarah Shopper Salazar says that as a white person, she grew up with a favorable impression of police. But she now recognizes it's not that way for everybody. That's why she got involved with the Body Cameras fundraiser.
It takes a little bit of sacrificing on my husband and I's part to be able to make a contribution. But when I think about it, I would rather do that for the benefit of my community than to just ignore it. There are people who are talking about their experiences, and they're not positive with our police.
But Shopper Salazar also emphasizes police are not doing all bad or all good. She says they're just like anyone else. She says we all have things to work on in our jobs, no matter what it is we do. She hopes body cameras make police better and help ensure everyone in the community feels safe. Rich Ugger reporting.
Passers-by have been getting quite a view outside of a home on Vernon Avenue in Normal. Instead of flower beds in the front yard, there are 15-foot stalks of corn. Reporter Cameron Kelly of WGLT talks with a front yard farmer about her crop.
Longtime gardener Erin Ripley Gutarik grew up out in the cornfields this summer for her family's home garden. They got their hands on some compost with a lot of nitrogen in it. Not every plant does well with that kind of soil. It can burn off the roots, but corn is the exception.
And then it just kind of evolved into, well, if we're going to plant some corn, let's plant a bunch of different kinds of corn. If we're going to plant a bunch of different kinds of corn, let's plant them in the order in which humanity developed them. And so then it became a timeline of corn.
That ended up being a lot of fun for the family to dig into.
Because we got varieties of corn from a bunch of friends and family. We ordered some internationally. To have to dig back through there and find out that most of these varieties date back to before written history, and definitely before European written history. Like most of these are pre-colonial, pre-Columbian. One of them was actually labeled as pre-Incan.
Erin says planting corn became an academic tool for her children, who are homeschooled. 15 varieties of corn were grown in their garden. Some were local, others were shipped to them internationally from Central America.
And I never expected to like save money or feed my family at all, because if I had, then I would have treated the plants and cared about the Japanese beetles and, done stuff like that. But we knew we weren't going anywhere for vacations, and this is our fifth year homeschooling too. So it was like, just consider that an educational expense. It's an educational project.
Her children learned about world history as well as a timeline of how Europeans versus the Western Hemisphere worked with corn.
And then the stuff that I ordered internationally came from what you could tell was a street address in Mexico or Guatemala, and it had somebody's name on it as the return address. So it was from an individual, especially the teosinte, the plant that's like the native ancestor of corn, like what they cultivated out to eventually become corn. Like that came in a tiny little Ziploc baggie about 1 inch by 2 inch. And it just had a homemade label on it.
Kernels were planted and the children took stats of the plants. They ended up with only 4 ears of edible corn. But Erin's family put it to use. On a summer day, the family made a sweet corn and melon and shrimp salad. The biggest tip Erin has for people at home wanting to grow corn is a little bit counterintuitive. Plant it in your front yard.
And we're on Vernon, so it's a very busy street with a lot of foot traffic too, so the squirrels aren't brave enough to go up in the front yard.
Next season, Erin's family will be planting a pollinator mix that brings butterfly traffic.
It's going to be very disappointing to everyone because I've had requests to do the same thing with beans. Please grow a timeline of rice. Please grow a timeline of wheat. But it is going to be flower bulbs.
So while Normal may have lost out on the sweet corn circus in Uptown Normal this year, Erin's family had a little corn festival of their own, right on Vernon Avenue. I'm Cameron Kelly.
There's more ahead on Statewide. We'll hear from former Illinois Governor George Ryan. That's coming up. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll compare two universities in Illinois and how they're taking different approaches to deal with COVID-19. But first, former Illinois Governor George Ryan has written a book about his moratorium on executions and commutation of capital sentences. It was written with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maurice Posley. The book is Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois. Edith Brady Lunny talked with both Posley and Ryan. Ryan says he had been a lifelong supporter of the death penalty, but the turning point for him was watching TV coverage of Anthony Porter being released from prison after journalism students found evidence to exonerate him.
I said to my wife, how does that happen in America? Mm-hmm. How does some guy get put on death row for 15, 16 years in this country, every day have to worry about when they're going to pull the switch to kill him, every morning for 16 years? What kind of a life is that? And then find out that he's innocent and kind of refuse to compensate him for his time. I think they only paid him about $150,000 for 15 years of misery in his life. But at least they didn't kill him. I was thankful for that. So that's really what really grabbed my attention on that issue. And I started to move forward on it.
Governor, in the book, you recall the big concerns that you had. You called it Illinois' shameful record of convicting innocent people and putting them on death row. When it comes to the death penalty, you can't afford mistakes, you said. Why do you think it was so challenging for you to convince others in Springfield that the system was so riddled with these obvious flaws?
I didn't really have a problem with when we asked for the moratorium. We didn't have too many objections, mm-hmm. as I recall. People that voted against it in the House, at least, and I'm sure that was true in the Senate, it passed pretty easy because people didn't want to be accused of being for executing an innocent person, if that would be the case. And they decided that maybe we should look at it. But for the most part, The problem came was when we tried to do away with it, make some changes in the system, because nobody wanted to look, and they never do if they're running for public office, but to look like they're soft on crime. They can do the things that that they just don't want to get caught on voting in the wrong way. So that was kind of the big problem I had there.
Maurice, why do you think it's important to continue this discussion now about the death penalty?
Well, we still have it in a lot of states, although I will say this, that there's a fair number of states that I call de facto abolition states because they haven't had an execution in 10 years. But the federal government has decided, our president decided, okay, we're going to start killing people that are on death row in the federal system. I think that George's story is as relevant today as it was then, because it really delivers this message about what is wrong with the system and how can the system be trusted and can you ever make a perfect system? There's a line from a philosopher that says, out of the crooked timber of life, no human ever made a perfect thing. And I'm paraphrasing there. And I do think this book should be required reading for every legislator who ever comes across this issue, every governor who has in a death penalty state who has to deal with it. I do think that our country one day will abolish the death penalty. When that will happen, you know, if you had asked me 10 years ago, will Illinois ever abolish the death penalty? And I said, would have said, I don't know if it would be in my lifetime. And then sure enough, in 2011, there it went. So when Governor Ryan imposed the moratorium, it was so momentous because no governor had ever done such a thing like that. And it drew attention to the issue of innocence, which had not been a compelling argument for a lot of people up to that point in time. The main debate over the death penalty was, is it morally right for the state to kill people to deter others from killing people? And the innocence debate that was really fueled by what the governor did propelled the abolition movement. Now, I think in more recent times, the financial argument has come to bear as well in a powerful way. And I think that it has provided, at least for some states, some political cover to abolish the death penalty, saying it's just too expensive a system. And it is an expensive system. But I think that beyond all that, the relevance is that the death penalty system is the same criminal justice system that we all are exposed to or is in place for all of us. It's just that the stakes are higher. The potential punishment is we're going to kill you. Many of the flaws that we see in the death penalty system are flaws that are not just unique to that. And that's why this is relevant beyond the death penalty.
Governor Ryan, you write about the very personal nature that your deliberations took on the death penalty. One of the sentences of death row inmates that you commuted in 2003 was that of Danny Edwards, who had killed your neighbor and friend, Steve Small, in 1987. And there were other horrific cases where guilt was certain. That struggle to recognize the suffering of victims is something that you write about. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
Well, it was not very pleasant, frankly. I didn't have anybody on my staff that stood with me. Everybody there was, I had to work against pretty much. Matt Bettenhausen was my guy for death penalty for problems, and he stood with me. But from my chief of staff to right down to everybody in the staff, they admonished me for doing what I was doing. But it was difficult, you know, and I met with both parties, people that had been sent to jail and the people that had their loved ones killed. And the victims' families were the toughest to deal with, and I understood that. They all said that they wanted closure and they wanted to see the person that killed their daughter or their son or somebody, they wanted to see him executed to get closure. And so it was a very difficult time for me during that period to keep moving along with it. But I did, and I still believe that it was the right thing to do, and I'd do it again, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Do you think enough changes have been made with the system, enough reforms have been made across the country that people should have confidence in any state that the death penalty is being used with full accuracy?
Well, Marsh just pointed out, you know, most states haven't had an execution in 10 years, so that's another thing that's probably false. They're going to have it. They do it. They're not fooling around, I suppose, if they're trying to send a message. But, you know, it was just one of those things that it seemed to be the right thing to do to me. If you got a system, and I appointed, you know, a commission that provided some 85 changes to the laws to make sure we didn't kill an innocent person. And, of course, it was an election year. And the only thing that passed the General Assembly after all of the work that commission put in was the tape recording of confessions. And it was an important part of the reform package, but that's the only thing the General Assembly would pass. And that's why I then had to commute the sentences of everybody, because I didn't want to leave office in the few days that I had left there and be at home watching the news to find out that some poor innocent guy that I ignored was executed, and he was an innocent man or woman. I always kind of likened it to flying an airplane from Boston to Chicago or however you want to go. And it crashed three times a week. Now, would you put the plane on the ground and try to fix it? Or would you continue to fly it for letting it crash three times a week? And that's what I said about the death penalty. You know, we've had enough of this, and we're crashing too many times. So we got to close down the system and find out what's wrong with it and get it fixed and still have it. And it wasn't politically popular, and it was impossible politically to pass. So that's why I ended up doing what I did.
Maurice, your work with the National Registry of Exonerations makes you keenly aware, I know, of the more than 2,600 wrongful convictions that have been recorded in the U.S. since 1989. Only Texas has more wrongful convictions on record than Illinois. We currently stand, I think, at 330 at this point. What does this number, 330 exonerations, say about the reliability of the justice system as a whole and the risk there is with the imposition of capital punishment?
Well, I think that any number that you're dealing with is a basement number, sadly. I like to say, well, I don't know if I like to say it, but I say that the good news is we're exonerating people. The bad news is we still have people to exonerate. We really don't know how many there are. Mm-hmm. We know the ones we know about. We don't know how many people served their sentence and went on with their lives and are never going to be exonerated. What it shows is, and what the registry, by accumulating this data, is that the system has been flawed. It continues to be flawed, but it is also, you know, I'm somewhat optimistic that by accumulating this information, it provides strength to people's arguments for change. And I do think that over the arc of time, going back to say 2000, when Governor Ryan declared the moratorium, we've seen improvements in how eyewitness identification procedures in terms.
Journalist Maurice Posley says the biggest barrier to reform is that there are more than 3,000 countries in the U.S., each with their own prosecutors and multiple law enforcement agencies, and he says that prevents systemic change. Posley and the former Illinois Governor George Ryan wrote a new book, Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois, and they spoke with Edith Brady Lunny. Two public universities in Illinois, located less than an hour drive away from each other, are taking two very different approaches to reopening this fall semester. One is testing and retesting students and staff. At the other campus, there's limited testing. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom starts the story on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Marissa Hardwick just got tested for COVID-19 inside a big white tent. She says collecting enough spit to take the saliva test can be a challenge, especially when you can't drink or eat anything for at least an hour before.
I like sour candy, so that's what I always think about, like, sour stuff. It makes my mouth salivate, so.
Hardwick is a senior majoring in kinesiology. She's impressed by the university's massive testing program. Faculty, staff, and students have to get tested at least once a week in order to enter campus buildings, twice a week for undergrads. So far, the U of I has conducted hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 tests with a positivity rate of less than 1%. But Hardwick is not surprised there are currently around 2,000 cases of COVID-19 on this campus of roughly 35,000 students living in the area and more than 13,000 faculty and staff members.
It's not a quiet school. You know, it's known for being a party location.
That may be why there are already more than twice as many COVID-19 cases on campus than what university researchers predicted for the entire semester. University officials blame the rise in cases on student behavior. Others, like anthropology professor Catherine Clancy, blame the university. She says the school didn't account for student behavior when they created their reopening plan.
We made them think they were going to come here and have maybe not a normal campus experience, but still a desirable campus experience, when what we really need them to do is so much more challenging and mentally taxing and distressing than what they could actually do.
Administrators placed students on temporary lockdown earlier this month, and so far it seems to be working. Daily case numbers have declined, but the total number of cases remains high compared to other universities and colleges nationwide. So far, though, university officials remain confident in their testing program. U of I epidemiologist Rebecca Lee Smith says the campus's testing program is the envy of other universities, who she says are testing mostly symptomatic people.
The majority of our cases are asymptomatic. So the number of cases we have is the iceberg. They have the tip.
About an hour drive away, there's another public university which has taken a different approach to testing on its campus. Dana Vollmer from member station WGLT in Normal picks up the story.
Since it reopened, Illinois State University has had about 1,400 positive COVID-19 test results on its campus of about 18,000 students living in the Bloomington-Normal area. Unlike the U of I, COVID-19 testing at ISU was optional until just last week, when the school announced that it will require students to get tested soon, but it's unclear when or how that will happen. Mary Closer is a junior at ISU. She says she and her friends are taking COVID-19 seriously, but some of her classmates aren't being as careful.
They're kind of like ruining it for everyone else.
Eduardo Monk is a freshman, one of the nearly 3,800 living in a dorm. He says he's careful about mask wearing. Still, he doesn't think college students have much to worry about if they do get the coronavirus.
And really, I'm not going to limit myself a whole lot. Again, I can't put my whole entire life on pause. There's a million more things I could die from just stepping outside my door.
ISU President Larry Dietz says most students are following the rules, and he says the university's COVID-19 numbers don't tell the whole story.
The truth is, many state universities don't test nearly as much as Illinois State does, and they don't transparently report positive cases as does ISU. Other universities test so often that their positivity rates skew lower through simple division.
So far, Illinois State University has conducted about 8,000 COVID-19 tests.
The University of Illinois, more than 300,000. Sarah Kobe is an epidemiologist at the University of Chicago. She calls ISU's optional testing program problematic.
To be fair, it is also the mode for basically every state and other large institution I know, which is, you know, allow testing, report those test results, but not enable testing in the way that allows us to understand trends in transmission, you know, really well. So, I mean, it's unquestionably risky.
Kobe says schools need to test students and staff every few days to catch the virus before it can spread. Without that kind of systematic surveillance testing, she says you can't really tell how many people are infected. And while Kobe calls the testing program created by the University of Illinois impressive, she says the school could have done a better job accounting for student behavior and how that might affect the spread of the virus.
And so I think a lot of boxes had to be checked, you know, to do this safely. And I don't think any university has really checked all of them.
Kobe says if university and college administrators had anticipated the magnitude of what's at stake and what it would take to open safely, more might have chosen not to bring students back to campus at all. I'm Lee Gaines.
And I'm Dina Vollmer.
There's more to come on Statewide, making it easier to locally source a key ingredient for beer making. That story's ahead. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, just as schools and offices were closing due to COVID-19, volunteers in Springfield started a Facebook group where members could offer and ask for meals, diapers, or anything else to help neighbors through the crisis. The group celebrated its six-month anniversary. Mary Hansen has more on how they continue to fill a need in Springfield.
On Tuesday nights, Jennifer Moore and her five children pile into their minivan and make a stop at a church doing a grocery giveaway.
We pick up food for seven families, and then we deliver it mainly to our side of town, but we do expand out a little bit.
They drop the bags off to people who responded in the Springfield Families Helping Families group on Facebook. A few volunteers started the group back in mid-March. 6 months into the public health and economic crisis, it's still a place where those with extra time or resources can offer assistance, and those who are in need can ask for help. Moore says she originally joined the group, which now counts more than 13,000 members, to make a request. She just had surgery and hadn't been able to get her stimulus check or unemployment payment. And at that moment, she was running low on shampoo.
So I read some of the posts and I seen how quickly people responded. And then that kind of took some of the nervousness away, seeing how helpful people really were.
Moore says a group member who lived nearby put together a whole care package with shampoo, toothpaste, deodorant, kids soap, and more. Moore was grateful, and when her health and financial situation improved over the summer,
then I started reaching out, helping other families that were in the situation that I was in.
Catherine Eastfold is an administrator for the group. She says one thing that surprised her was how many people were like Moore, posting to both request and offer.
We don't have these big, broad categories of these are the people who give and these are the people who need things.
Group members offered hand-me-down clothes, toys, and household items. Some ask about information on rent or utility assistance. Eastfold and the other administrators keep busy responding to up to 100 posts per day, making sure requests follow Facebook's rules and organizing posts into categories like basic needs and information. She says another big task is ensuring the group is a welcoming place to both give and receive.
We have an absolute no tolerance policy for any bullying that we see, for any rudeness that we see.
If a rude comment or prying question appears, the administrators can delete them and temporarily mute commenters or even kick them out of the group. Eastfold says it's essential to keep the discourse civil because it can take a lot of courage to ask for help, and requests are taken at face value. This part gives John Kelker pause. He's the executive director of the United Way of Central Illinois, which funds social service agencies and offers an information hotline. He says the online group is filling a need.
I think they're meeting a need that hasn't been met before.
Kelker says he wants to make sure assistance is in the right place.
I would ask anyone who's offering help to make sure their help's in the right place and that their heart is working along with their head to make sure their volunteer services and the gifts that they're giving are meeting their own expectations.
Eastfold, the group administrator, says the group follows principles of mutual aid. She gives a recent example of a mom asking the group for a folding chair for her child to use when remote learning. Looking around her office, Eastfold saw she had one and offered it up.
You don't necessarily need a grant or a nonprofit that's dedicated to providing that in order to get to people. You have to have neighbors who are generous, who have a little extra stuff and a little time on their hands.
Eastfold says during the coronavirus pandemic, it's inspiring to see the radical reliance on neighbors.
The more that we can take the pressure off of particular individuals to address this crisis and instead take this burden on as a community, I think that's a win for Springfield.
The administrators of the Springfield Families Helping Families group say they plan to continue as long as they're needed. I'm Mary Hansen.
Illinois will give some applicants for cannabis dispensary licenses a second look. Only a fraction of would-be pot shop owners advance to a lottery for social equity licenses, reserved for those whose lives have been affected by the war on drugs. Senior cannabis advisor Toy Hutchinson says there were inconsistencies in the grading of applications by a consulting firm that was charged with reviewing them.
We do not want a world where people who absolutely earned points that they should have received are denied those points. So we're going to take our time to make sure that this is as thorough and equitable and fair as we possibly can make it.
Hundreds of applicants were vying for 75 licenses, but just 21 qualified for a lottery. Now, unsuccessful applicants will get an opportunity to prove they should have scored higher, and that potentially allows them entrance into the lottery. The number of small breweries across the Midwest has increased dramatically over the past 20 years. The beer makers market themselves as high quality and being hyper-local, but there is one essential ingredient that is difficult to get nearby, hops. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All says some people would like to see that change, but it may be on a very small level.
To make beer, you take water, add barley for starch, yeast for fermentation, and hops for aroma and flavor. The hop is the flower part of a family of vines, and how much and what kind you add determines how the beer tastes. Patrick Byers wanted to see if he could grow hops in the Midwest for local breweries. The results were mixed.
It's going to be more expensive to grow hops here in Missouri than it is in some of the more favored production areas, you know, such as the Pacific Northwest. And our yields are not going to meet those yields that we see in more favorable growing climates.
Byers is a horticulturist for the University of Missouri Extension. He says the dry and cool conditions in Washington State or Central Europe are perfect for growing lots of kinds of hops. His 3-year project showed that just a couple of kinds of hops can grow in the hot, humid, and long days of the Midwest. And fewer kinds of hops means fewer flavor options for beer. Microbreweries market themselves as having better and more diverse flavors than Budweiser or Miller. But Byers says his pilot program wasn't a total bust.
If a craft brewer is interested in making a unique seasonal type brew that, you know, really reflects local conditions, then they may be interested in sourcing Missouri hops, recognizing that each year is going to be a, you know, somewhat unique experience, you know, such as a vintage would be on a wine.
Researchers are having a similar experience in Nebraska. Stacy Adams is a horticulturist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's concluding a study on hop production in his state. He says the Midwest's inconsistent and unfavorable weather will keep hops a niche crop, limited to being an option for small farmers.
So like a family farm that might have like a truck farm, vegetable gardening, or vegetable production, and then they would do hops along that lines too.
Adam says Midwest hops could be a small part of a farm run by people who are good at marketing and selling directly to customers. Dave Gleason agrees with some of Adam's conclusions. He owns and operates Oak Creek Hops, a 2-acre hop farm in Kearney, Nebraska. He says marketing is critical to his farm's success, specifically in recruiting craft brewers to try Midwest hops and convincing them there's no sacrifice in going local.
I think they're coming to the point where they're liking them more and more because they get a higher quality flavor or higher aromas out of them, and they can use a little bit less of them.
Gleason says Midwest hops have a stronger, fruitier flavor and can be the primary provider of hops for craft brewers. Gleason says there is room for expansion in the market, and hops can be a better use of a lot of Midwest farmland.
There's acreage that maybe doesn't produce the greatest corn and soybeans out in the Midwest, or they're set aside smaller acres maybe that can be utilized to grow hops on.
Ultimately, it will take buy-in from the craft brewers to make Midwest hops a growth crop. Josh Stacy of Public House Brewing Company in St. James, Missouri, is standing in his brewery while a machine is whirring away putting beer in cans. He says being local is very important, and he likes the idea of taking a chance on local hops, even if it has to be part of a special brew.
And it's based on that growing season. I think that would be the thing that would be interesting about this is to have that, and maybe it's an anniversary type thing, you know, where we're going to bring in the load that year and, you know, potentially try something with it.
Stacy says his company is thinking about growing its own hops on property behind the brewery or talking to local farmers. But if that happens, it will still be a while. It can take hops 3 years of cultivation to produce a usable crop. And Stacy says most of the hops he uses will continue to come from the Pacific Northwest for the foreseeable future. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
The fallout from a ransomware attack at an Illinois community college is far from over. Peter Medlin gives us an update.
In April, Illinois Valley Community College's servers shut down. It happened soon after COVID-19 closed the campus and shifted classes online. Hackers locked the college out of its own networks. That caused its website and email system to crash. In the directory where files should be, the hackers left a message demanding cash for ransom.
They didn't give any specifics. They just basically said, "We encrypted your stuff. If you want it back, email us at this address."
That's Chris Dunlap, Director of Information Technology Services at IVCC. The college's administrators decided to not respond to the message. Instead, Dunlap says they hired outside consultants who unlocked their servers before online classes could be disrupted.
We were able to recover most of our data and our major servers that contained all the student information and course registration and that kind of stuff.
In the months since the ransomware incident, IVCC has had to rebuild and reinforce its security systems. The college invested in backup strategies for its servers, and President Jerry Corcoran says the school is still working with consultants on forensic analysis.
I think the safe answer is there isn't anything that's 100% conclusive at this point, only that somebody was able on the outside to gain entrance into the system. But there isn't anything that we could say with 100% certainty as to what data ended up being extracted.
Following the initial attack, the school issued a press release and sent messages to its staff with security tips. Those included information on how to place fraud alerts and security freezes on a credit file, while stating the school had, quote, no evidence that any data had been misused. Fast forward to this month. Brett Callow reached out to WNIJ after seeing an article about the initial attack. He's a threat analyst at MSASoft, a cybersecurity solutions company that makes anti-malware and antivirus software. Callow says Illinois Valley's data did leak online. That includes, he says, bank records, budget calculations, scanned documents, and photos of its employees.
It's actually extremely difficult to tell what's happened during these incidents. Systems are obviously totally scrambled. The criminals may have taken steps to obscure what actions they actually took. It's like walking into your house that's been trashed by burglars and trying to work out whether anything was stolen. It's
Sibin Mohan is a research professor in the computer science department at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He researches security, not so much how to prevent attacks, but how to mitigate damage. He says it's hard to say exactly why the cyber criminals held onto the data for so long before leaking it.
They were maybe analyzing these records for like the last few months, trying to see if they can hack somebody else whose name is there or try to get some money from other people.
Since they didn't receive their ransom, they could also just want to be as disruptive as possible and make it available. But why Illinois Valley Community College? Gong Wang is a professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His research focuses on data mining, security, and privacy. He says schools are easy targets, and hackers are looking for two things: sensitive data and organizations that may not be as well protected.
That sort of combination usually goes to local hospitals or local universities where there's an enormous amount of valuable data, but their security protection might not up to the game compared to large companies.
Sibin Mohan says it's important for the college to assume that there's more data leaked than what was just published.
Bank records are quite telling, right? In the sense that they tell what the transactions are and who you're transacting with. Depending on how you use that information, you might be able to like hack other people's records.
He says any data dump is bad, but there could be a small silver lining. Now their forensic specialists have a better idea of exactly what data was taken and who to contact. Educational institutions are increasingly common targets of ransomware. According to MSASoft, at least 89 colleges and universities were affected in 2019, and by June of 2020, at least 30 were attacked. The University of California, San Francisco recently paid over $1 million in ransom in exchange for the school's confidential information. Mohan says for smaller schools like IVCC, it's still a big problem because they deal with so many people, vendors, contractors, and other businesses. The college is still holding many of its classes online, but the IVCC faculty union recently said at a board meeting that the school still doesn't have an academic events calendar or an online course catalog. Illinois Valley's IT director Chris Dunlap says that also has to do with the lingering effects of the ransomware. The faculty union's president wonders how many students gave up when they couldn't find a list of current classes. It's yet another possible ripple effect of the attack. I'm Peter Medlin.
And that's it for this episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Be sure to check the website statewideshow.com for links to the stories you hear each week. Also, our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.